Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. If you could take a seat, if you could find one. I am Gail Harriet, chair of the Civil Rights Practice Group, and I have two things to say really quickly before we get started. First, you too can be active in the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group. If you are interested, talk to Dean Reuter or Liz Seary after this presentation, or email any of us. Second, I have the pleasure of introducing our moderator today, Rachel Brand. It is a very easy job since Rachel is familiar to most of you as a member of the Federalist Society's leadership for many years now. If somehow you missed the news earlier this year, she is now Associate Attorney General of the United States of America, one of many very great appointments of the Trump administration. One more thing, though. As with many of the Trump appointments, the vote in the Senate was not unanimous. I mean, go figure. Abraham Lincoln could not get a unanimous vote out of these people these days. But let's make sure that her welcome is absolutely Federalist Society unanimous.
Good to see everybody. It's always good to be here at the Federalist Society. I, for some years, served as the chairman of the litigation practice group and had the role that Gail has here today. So this is a great turnout, and I'm delighted to be here with such a distinguished panel of experts on this topic of race and sex as drivers of the administrative state. My role is simply as the moderator. I'm going to introduce the panelists, each of whom will give a 6 to 8 minute opening presentation. I may ask some questions or ask them to respond to each other, and then at about 1:30, we'll open it up for questions from the audience, and then we'll end at 2 o'clock. All right, so Gail Harriet, who is very well known here to the Federalist Society, will go first. She is a current commissioner on the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. She has a long career in academia, including many years on the George Mason University and San Diego School of Law faculties, where she teaches and writes on civil rights matters and torts. She's also been a lawyer in private practice. She worked for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and she clerked for Judge Seymour Simon on the Illinois Supreme Court. Speaking second will be Professor Theodore Shaw, who's a law professor. Are you going second, Ted?
Yeah.
You are, okay. Law professor and director of the Center for Civil Rights at UNC Law School. He has a distinguished career in academia at other schools as well, including the University of Michigan and Columbia before joining UNC. He spent 26 years at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, serving in many capacities, ultimately including president of the organization. Speaking third will be Professor Shep Melnick of the Boston College. He's a professor of American political science. He teaches on a wide variety of poli-sci topics and is an expert on administrative government. He's also taught at several other schools, including Harvard and Brandeis. And then finally, right here to my right, Peter Kersenow, another current commissioner on the Civil Rights Commission, serving in his third term. He is also a former member of the NLRB under President Bush and has decades of experience in private practice where he practices both labor and employment law. All of their bios are in longer form in your program. And so we'll start out with Gail.
The theme of this conference is, of course, the administrative state and its phenomenal growth over the last century. That includes a focus on the bad stuff, its tendency towards overregulation, and its anti-democratic tendencies. The thesis we're talking about on this civil rights panel is this. For both good and bad reasons, a significant part of the expansion of the administrative state has been driven by issues of race and sex. Now, some of that is obvious and good. There have been a lot of civil rights legislation in the last 60 years. When that legislation is well drafted, with due attention to the difficulties inherent in governance by administrative agencies, and when it is faithfully executed, it will create administrative activity. You know, that's fine. But a lot of it's not like that. Some of the legislation is not so well drafted, and even when it is well drafted, it's not always faithfully executed. There's something about race and sex issues. From the transgender locker room guidance on down, advocates of limited government and of the notion that policy should be set for our by our elected representatives and rather than administrative agencies, they've been especially ineffective at reining in the excesses of the administrative state when dealing with, or when the administrative state purports to be dealing with, issues of race and sex. And part of the reason is that our elected representatives, when they do try to intervene, they get called racist or sexist, and well, you know, they don't like that. Whether their reticence is political prudence or moral cowardice is your call. You know, it's complicated, and it's not, I don't think there's a single answer to that question. Another part of the reason for that ineffectiveness, though, is that too many conservative leaders don't think race and sex are important issues. They see it as off to the side somewhere, even something that can be safely ignored, and that's a mistake. The mistake has two sides to it. Part is that conservative leaders, and here I mean not just political leaders, but religious leaders, civic leaders, lawyers at the Federalist Society, whatever. As a group, we have not done a great job at appreciating the difficulty of the task of bringing African Americans and other minorities, and to a lesser extent women, into the mainstream. There are some notable exceptions, including some in this room. But hence, we haven't put as much effort as I would have preferred into articulating the conservative vision into how to smooth the way. There are many people in our country today who are tempted by the siren call of identity politics. Some of their concerns are legitimate. They just need a little reformation of those, a little rechanneling. If looking at their concerns through the identity, through the lens of race and sex, or through the lens of identity politics is the wrong way, and I think it is, what's the right way? What's the conservative way to look at their concerns? Second, conservative leaders have been very bad at recognizing when progressive policies on race and sex are leading us in a direction. They've been bad at recognizing that the direction that those policies are leading us is not a good direction. It leads to race and sexual resentments. It leads to identity politics. And again, there are notable exceptions among conservatives here, some of them in the room. After decades of these policies, when the predictable results happen, too many people shrug their shoulders and wonder how it happened. I wish I had time to talk about all the examples of the administrative agencies run amok on civil rights issues, but I'm just one panelist here with 8 minutes, and we're going to have to share the pain here on the panel instead. I'm going to confine myself to one of the original issues, and that is Title VII and disparate impact, because I think it fits the administrative agency theme best. Back in 1964, when Congress passed Title VII, it was understood by Republicans, and I think Democrats too, to be a relatively small tweak to the common law that employment relationships were at will unless the parties agreed otherwise, which they often did. That is, the employer and the employee, or the job applicant, could enter or exit an employment relationship for good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all. Supporters of Title VII understood it as saying, yeah, sure, good reason, bad reason, or no reason at all, so long as the employer is not motivated by race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. They didn't want, back in 1964, they didn't want the EEOC or the courts second-guessing employers unless the court finds the employer is motivated by one of those five criteria, because second-guessing about complex human relationships is usually going to be guessing wrong, which is why we don't have an Office of Spousal Selection or Office of Best Friends, not yet anyway. We tend to think that government's choosing your mates, choosing your close associates, is not such a great idea except in very special circumstances. But within just a few years of Title VII's passage, the EEOC, in part motivated by the belief that it must do something fast about the unrest in urban centers back in the late 60s, They invented disparate impact liability, which looked not at the employer's intent to discriminate by race or sex in choosing particular job qualifications, but rather the effects that those job qualification choices will have. If a given job qualification had a disparate impact, it was presumptively a violation of Title VII. It was up to the employer to rebut that presumption by showing that it had a business necessity, which turned out to be a pretty high standard. After all, they're talking necessity here. It didn't matter whether the employer, either consciously or unconsciously, was motivated by race. It was a question of disparate impact. As far as I'm aware, historians have agreed that this is not what Congress had intended. But the Supreme Court nevertheless deferred to the EEOC in its interpretation of Title VII in Griggs versus Duke Power Company. Perhaps the biggest problem with disparate impact liability is that, wait for it, all job qualifications have a disparate impact on some protected group. Remember, there are a lot of religions, a lot of national origin groups out there. As a group, men are stronger than women, while women are generally more capable of fine handiwork. Chinese and Korean Americans score higher on standardized math tests and other measures of mathematical ability than most other national origin groups. Unitarians are much more likely to have a college degree than Baptists. It's a complicated world. Did you know, for example, and this is Thomas Sowell's favorite one, so I love to give it too, Cambodian Americans are disproportionately likely to have experience in the donut industry. So here's the rub. In 1964, the 88th Congress was very concerned about creating an administrative agency to enforce Title VII that would be too powerful in their view. The decision to deny the EEOC substantive rulemaking power was very, very deliberate. But soon after the EEOC opened for business, it began issuing various kinds of substantive guidances, they call them, interpreting Title VII. Not subject to notice and comment, not easily challenged in court, because in theory they are not final agency actions. They're just helpful advice on how the agency interprets the statute or which violations they consider most serious. But an employer would have to be rock stupid to ignore a guidance without an extremely good reason, especially after the early 1970s, when the authority to bring pattern and practice litigation was transferred from the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice to the EEOC. An excellent way to get the EEOC to sue an employer is for the employer to ignore the EEOC's helpful guidances. An EEOC official even bragged back in the 70s that these interpretations, through them, the agency was able to transform an apparently weak agency into a strong one. And that same guy bragged that the agency wasn't really all that concerned about whether the courts would agree with the guidances. But look at what you get when you combine the fact that every job qualification has a disparate impact with the EEOC's aggressive use of guidances backed up by the threat of litigation. The EEOC can issue a guidance claiming correctly that any employer practice, anyone that it doesn't like is having or could have a disparate impact. It has nearly complete discretion to prohibit any kind of job qualification if it really wants to. And it can be more or less retroactive. Think about what that means with regard to the rule of law and for the notion that we are governed by our elected representatives. A good example, and I think that Pete Kersenau will elaborate on this, is the EEOC's criminal background check guidance. Knock me over with a feather if Congress at any time intended to limit employer discretion to determine whether to hire a job applicant with a criminal record. The whole point of Title VII is that employers need to choose employees based on their actual record rather than their race or sex, and criminal record is certainly part of that. I happen to believe the federal government should have programs that help reintegrate those who serve their time back into society. I am a fan of the tax deduction for this purpose because employers who want to participate get to self-select in that program. This should never have been cast as a race issue under Title VII. I am going to stop there because no less an authority than the Associate Attorney General will cause the gavel to come down upon me. My bottom line is that representative democracy, the rule of law, as well as fairness, justice, and economic prosperity all depend on conservatives paying more attention to civil rights law and policy, as well as more attention to how to address the legitimate concerns of those who might otherwise be inclined to frame their concerns in terms of identity politics. Thank you.
So, a number of us agreed that we would rather sit on our duffs than stand at the podium and do this panel thing, but let me first say that I'm honored to be here. I don't know how long I've been coming to Federal Society conventions, and sometimes I leave feeling like a liberal or progressive pinata. Sometimes I have left steamed and upset and angry, and other times I feel like there's been a good discourse. I'm probably, as time goes on, even more and more inclined to have these kinds of opportunities. Unlike what many people say, there are a lot of people who disagree philosophically and ideologically, I'm one of them, who believe that it is important to have discourse and disagreement. And the other thing is that the labels that we either take on or wear or other people put on us are often insufficient. You know, to call oneself a conservative or a liberal doesn't quite capture all the nuances of the thoughts, the beliefs, the struggles that we have over a range of issues. Having said that, I know I disagree with almost everybody on this panel, if not everybody, on some important points. Gail and I have had our exchanges in the past. I hope to continue to have them in the future. But let me just share a few thoughts, and there was one that I want to end with that I really thought about starting with, and so I want to make sure I get to that. I know that's in my own hands. The term identity politics, which is much more popular now and is kind of like the flavor of the day, is a term that I don't remember, at least 10, 20, 15 years ago, certainly when I started practicing civil rights law. And it's a loaded term. And it's a term that generally is being thrown at people who think of themselves as more progressive or you know, who do civil rights work, or more specifically, particularly, though I may be wrong about this, you know, it feels like it's being loaded and thrown at people of color, particularly African Americans. If it's a term that has any use at all, I can tell you that black folks didn't invent what we call identity politics. I hope I don't need to explain that anymore, but question and answers, you know, you can come at me in question and answers, and I'll explain it if need be. The fact is that we now are, as I often point out, we're now 398 years after the arrival of the first Africans involuntarily at Jamestown. Another way of putting that is that we are 2 years short of the 400th anniversary. I've been thinking about this for a long time. And when I think about the continuum with respect to subordination under law in this country, it is a continuum. It's not the view that many people have that slavery ended in 1865. It did, although some people will point out that it has continued by another name. There's even a book, Slavery by Another Name. You can read that and look at that. But the continuum, of course, is Jim Crow segregation, subordination by law, if we think about our country, didn't end until the late 1960s, right around 1970, And then we saw ushered in a period of attack in the form of anti-affirmative action, et cetera, a rebuff of school desegregation, et cetera. But the administrative state that Gail is talking about with respect to race only began to take form in the late 1950s with the passage of the Civil Rights Act. And then, of course, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Titles II, Title IV, Title VII in particular, more about Title VII. And then, of course, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, one could think about the enforcement of Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which did take part of the administrative state, the government, the Justice Department, Civil Rights Division, you know, under the Attorney General's authority with respect to the enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. And then, of course, the 1968 Civil Rights Act, Fair Housing, all of HUD's fair housing responsibilities. Do those provisions require governmental enforcement efforts? Of course they do. Of course they do. How would these measures be enforced if not by the government? The reality is that voluntary cessation of racial discrimination in this country is simply not a major cause of what abandonment we've had of the segregative state on the federal or the local level. The question isn't whether or not the government has a role to play. The question is, what is that role? For most of those 350 years before the end of the 60s, it was a role that was segregative. I'm not going to go into it now because this isn't the time. It is the time and the place, but we don't have it. The segregation as it exists in this country that we take for granted and don't even think about didn't happen accidentally or, depending on your point of view, serendipitously. It is the consequence, and I'm talking about housing segregation but other forms, of years and years, decades and decades of governmental action on the state, local, and federal level that have interacted with the deeds of private actors to create the segregation that we see today. So we've only begun to address this over the last 48 or 50 years, depending on how you count. And if you do the math, this is why I did the introduction I did, we're talking about somewhere 84%, 88% of the days of the existence of people of African descent in what's now the United States have been spent under either slavery or Jim Crow segregation, governmental subordination. So we've only begun to have the government play another kind of role. Let me say a few things and then cease with respect to some of the provisions that I've alluded to. Title VII. Title VII is a favorite target of conservatives with respect to, in particular, the effect standard. Gail, when you started out talking about how we got the effect standard, I thought you started out talking about it in terms of administrative agencies before you got to the fact that the Supreme Court decided in Griggs v. Duke Power Company that there was an effects test. And so I was ready to jump and make that correction, but didn't need to. You alluded to Griggs v. Duke Power Company. But that standard, whether it's applied in the context of employment or any other standard, but particularly employment, is not a standard that simply says that if there's a difference that we see with respect to the effect of a certain policy or practice, et cetera, that is illegal. That's not quite the way it works. It's a starting point. It opens up an inquiry. And what Griggs v. Duke Power Company said was not that there's automatically either a finding or a presumption of illegality. The question is whether or not the practice or the policy that has a discriminatory impact is one that is justifiable, whether it's a necessary practice or policy related to the job function that one is engaged in. There, of course, is the rub. That's where we get into a lot of disagreements. But I ask, as a starting point, what is it about asking the question whether or not a particular policy or practice is necessary if it has discriminatory or disparate impact that bothers people, except if you think that we shouldn't be using the time and the energy or expending that on those kinds of matters because they're not important enough. If we do, and I suspect that with some folks we might, then we just have a different point of view and we have different values about what's important and what isn't. I remind us again, or I certainly am conscious myself, of the fact that we've only begun to root out the impact of these decades and decades and hundreds of years of racial subordination and inequality that still exist. You know, I've come to the Federalist Society conventions, but also been engaged in other debates in which for years, in recent years, we talked about whether or not race is still an issue, whether we've reached colorblind America. I'm not sure anybody in this room would debate that nowadays, or if you did, I wouldn't really engage in that debate because I think it would be superfluous. But the point I'm making is that, yes, we need the government, whether we're talking about Bob Jones University, you know, versus IRS, whether we're talking about the effort to desegregate long-running Adams case, you know, the federal government's responsibility with elementary and secondary education and colleges and universities, and we can talk about what was successful there and what wasn't, because there is a critique to level at the work that civil rights lawyers like those of us at the Legal Defense Fund did. Fair enough. But whether we talk about, you know, the impact of policies that segregate people in housing, whether or not HUD has a role, I don't shrink from what's called the administrative state having a role in all of those things if you believe that we still have work to do with respect to rooting out governmental inequality. Last thing. I'm in North Carolina now, and Peter, whom I've bumped heads with many times, I hope you don't mind, you know, we had a good catching up a few moments. He asked me, how am I doing there? Well, just fine, thank you. My wife loves it. My kids love it. I love living in North Carolina. But I said, my problem is the politics of North Carolina now. And there is a viciousness in the people who hold power in that state right now. And it's not only limited to North Carolina, but it is particularly true of North Carolina. The notion of crushing anybody and destroying anybody with which one disagrees. You know, I look at the people who are in the legislature, on the Board of Governors, in other places, and I ask myself, what kind of people are these? When I see what they're doing and in the way they do it. If you're not clear about what I'm talking about, I'd be glad to talk to any of you about it. But the point that I'm ending on is this. There's a better way for us to engage in discourse, in talking about issues about which we disagree than the one that is characterized either in North Carolina politics or, for that matter, on national politics. I may be naive. I may be. You know, it may be that when you're on the short end of the stick these days, you want to believe in those things. But I think that if we don't find a better way to engage with one another, it's at all of our peril, at our national peril. I don't like the place where we are in as a country right now. And to be clear, NFL protests notwithstanding, I may be wandering a bit, but not that much. This is my country. I view myself and those who do this work as patriotic as anyone else is. Not everybody believes that. There has to be a place for a special discourse when we talk about the continued divisions about race in this country, because it remains if not our greatest dilemma, one of our nation's greatest dilemmas. And so it's in that context, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to share a few thoughts with you here. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I come before you with two disabilities. One is I'm not a lawyer. I'm just a political scientist. And I should probably add, don't even consider myself a conservative. I probably voted for Democrats as much as Ted has. I assume you vote mainly as I have. Also, I have an ear infection. I can't hear myself very well. So I hope my voice sounds better to you than it does to me. In many ways, regulation of educational institutions under Title IX of the Education Amendments of 1972 illustrates all of the hazards of the administrative state that Justice Gorsuch talked about last night. At the same time, though, I fear that the term administrative state is a misnomer, and I will try to point out how talking in terms of the administrative state might hide from us some of the features of Title IX that definitely need to be addressed. Most of the Obama administration's initiatives under Title IX are probably familiar to all of you, so I won't go over them in detail. If you want a very detailed review, I have a forthcoming book called The Transformation of Title IX. You can 300 pages of detail, and you can pre-order it on Amazon. But very quickly, Title IX simply says that institutions that receive federal funding, educational funding, cannot discriminate on the basis of sex. The legislative history of this law is very sparse. It was a floor amendment. When President Nixon signed it in 1972, he didn't even mention Title IX, part of the omnibus bill. New York Times didn't even mention it when they were explaining what Congress had passed. For many decades, the only controversial issue was athletics. And the reason for that was because that was the one area in most schools that we segregated by sex. And we tried to figure out what separate but equal means in the area of athletics. Starting in 2010, the Obama administration began a campaign to use both Title VI and Title IX and Title VI to make major changes in federal education policy. I'm going to just focus here on the sexual harassment, sexual assault rules, say a little bit about transgender. But in 2011 and 2014, as you probably know, the Obama administration issued a Dear Colleague letter and a detailed question and answer guidance document that required schools to take very dramatic action to address the problem of sexual harassment and sexual assault on campuses. What is best known is procedural requirements for people involving people who are accused of sexual misconduct, especially the preponderance of the evidence rules. But I think even more important has been many other features of this guidance. The requirement of extensive training for basically everyone in the university and in public schools. And I'd actually encourage you to read Emily Yoffe's Atlantic article on this, so you get a sense of the type of training that is being required. And a really terrific law review article, California Law Review, by Jeannie Suk and Jason Gerson on what they call the sex bureaucracy. There are very extensive requirements for preventing sexual assault and sexual harassment. Services to schools, not only to those people who have experienced sexual assault and sexual harassment on campus, but those who have experienced off campus, even by non-students. The requirements have very elaborate rules about internal compliance offices, requiring creation of quite large units within universities that are largely autonomous from other parts of the university. And finally, I'll just say that this is not just about sexual conduct, it is about speech about sexual matters. Jokes, innuendos, disparaging comments about masculinity and femininity, this is very far-reaching. And it has been enforced through an enforcement procedure that is extremely expensive for universities, both in terms of time and reputation. And I think they're designed to do that. not to put too fine a point on it, but these investigations, which could last years, are meant to bludgeon schools into compliance. Less consequential, but in some ways more dramatic, were the rules on transgender rights, in which the Office for Civil Rights said that if, when schools have sex-segregated facilities, you must allocate those facilities on the basis of gender identity, not biological sex. Now, those have never taken effect for various reasons, but really show that there is was a very dramatic effort to change the way in which we think about sex in education. Now, this has a number of troubling features. I'm sure most of you are aware of this. One is, this was based, these rules were based on a very sparse legislative record. I would say a weak to non-existent legislative basis. For sexual harassment, the term sexual harassment wasn't even in use in 1972. That really didn't come until a number of years later. Now, the courts, this is actually the point that Ted Shaw made about the courts and agencies, the courts did start in the 1970s to say that sexual harassment is a form of sexual discrimination. But they could never explain why, or they could never agree on why. And the why was important because it says what form regulation should take. OCR didn't begin to say anything about sexual harassment until the 1990s, 25 years later. And meantime, Congress had said absolutely nothing. Second problem, again, you're probably generally aware of this. All of these rules by the Obama administration, and I shouldn't single out the Obama administration because this is true of many previous administrations,